Hey, Jonah.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Good. So it's been a while since we've done Vlogging Heads, but it's good to be back in the saddle.
Yes, it is. Good Yuletide tidings to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Season's greetings. We were going to start, since we haven't actually talked since the election of our 44th president, we were going to talk about Obama and how he's doing.
Yes, some of us refer to it as the recent unpleasantness.
I see. Some of us refer to basically the last 8 years as that, and then not so recent. So I'll start. You know, I think this may all be CW. I think Obama, you know, you can understand a lot of what Obama's doing as a reaction both against Bush and, in some degree, I think, against the two Democratic presidents who preceded him as well. I mean, unlike Bush, I think the choice of Jones to try to have a really strong national security advisor is very much a reaction, I think, to the bipartisan sense that Condoleezza Rice was not able to effectively manage the foreign policy process in the first Bush term with disastrous results. I think there's the self-conscious intellectualism of the group is also, I think, very clearly a kind of a setting a different tone from Bush, and I think sets the tone that Obama, I think, you know, Obama likes to think of himself as somebody who likes to have smart people in a room disagreeing with him, which is not the sense that one gets from George W. Bush from the books that have been written about the administration. But I also think that, I also think that the attempt to choose people like Daschle and Rahm Emanuel, who are real inside power players in the Democratic Congress, or formerly in the Democratic Congress, is a very smart reaction to both Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, who had a lot of trouble even with their own parties in Congress in their first year in office. And I think what's fascinating to me about Obama's selections is that he is not, I think another reaction to Bush is that Bush prized loyalty a great deal. I think he was very loyal to people who were loyal to him, and that was very important to him. I think what's so interesting about Obama is that in significant number of decisions, he has bypassed people who were his loyalists for people who he thought brought some other kind of political or intellectual benefit. And I think that's that says something very intriguing about him. I think actually something generally pretty hopeful, because I think that one of the problems of the Bush administration, and not just the Bush administration, I think you saw this with Johnson's administration and others, is an excessive focus on loyalty, which doesn't end up rewarding the right kind of people. I think what's interesting about Obama is he has not made loyalty to him the most important criteria in his selections.
Yeah, I really don't have full disclosure. My wife thinks that Vlogging Heads is sorely in need of more heat and less light, and that we should pick more fights. So she's going to be upset with me again. But I think
tell her to get on here and start mixing it up.
That's a good idea. I think you're generally right. I think Obama's picks, you know, I mean, look, they're a lot better. I mean, you know. A lot of my crowd, we were half expecting everyone to come in wearing, you know, Che T-shirts. And I think he's done a good and surprising job, surprisingly good, staffing his cabinet. Here are, though, where I have, I want to say misgivings, but where I think he might be being too clever by half. You know, what's his name? Richard Epstein at University of Chicago, he had an interesting line about Obama's cabinet, which he said, you know, they're all really, really smart people, but they're such self-styled intellectuals, they will always go past a good solution to find a brilliant one. I think that you could have a best and the brightest kind of thing. You know, it's funny how everyone keeps referring to the best and the brightest and the whiz kids, and they never seem to really sort of acknowledge the point that book doesn't end well, and that there are real problems with the arrogance of intellect. I also think it's worth pointing out that pretty much correct me if I'm wrong about this, but at least in my memory, every new president's cabinet picks are generally greeted with praise. You know, Bush's were in 2000. Clinton's were in 92, with the exception of his, you know, botched attorney general stuff. Reagan's were. I mean, there's always this sort of, gosh, isn't it exciting to have a new cast come in, feeling to a lot of this. But more importantly, I think there's a real...
Yes, although I think you, as you acknowledge, though, there often are marred by a scandal or two.
True.
You have to, and so we did, you know, it's, again, amazing that Obama hasn't had that. Because even Bush, remember, had that Linda Chavez thing,
which
was,
so.
You know, kind of Zoe Bear thing. So this has become kind of, you know, standard that you have one or two of these things. But it's interesting that Obama hasn't had even one.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, although there's still time.
Yeah.
Who knows what's going to happen with Rahm Emanuel and Blagojevich. But generally, no, I think you're generally right. I think the real problem, though, is I think it is – there's a real hubris to this. I agree with you that, you know, a problem with the Bush administration was its excessive focus on loyalty that I think that stemmed from one of the more under-examined aspects of Bush's biography, which is his role as the political enforcer for his dad's administration.
Yeah, absolutely. His relationship with Sununu, he really didn't like people he thought were disloyal to his dad. Yeah.
Right, and I think that informed a great deal of his political vision.
Yeah.
That said, you know, there's a you get a slight whiff of generals fighting the last war out of Obama's cabinet staffing. You know, he doesn't want to repeat the mistakes of Bush, but he was never destined to repeat Bush's mistakes. So the idea of, I mean, I understand the optics, you know, the sort of the appearance issue of embracing all of this, you know, all these eggheads and all the, you know, this kind of thing as a break with the past. But he was already a break with the past, and the idea that he was going to make the same mistakes Bush did. Is sort of ludicrous on its face. I think even Obama's biggest fans can grasp that. And so this idea of sort of picking the apples to Bush's oranges is more backward looking than I think people realize. And this whole team of rivals nonsense that people have been quoting, I mean, I think it's a really bad analogy, because the team of rivals things didn't work, as far as I understand it, all that well for Lincoln in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you think that it matters, you know, if the issue is, oh, people disagreeing with you in the room is what it means to be a great president or, you know, a intellectually secure president, I think that, too, has sort of a comic book version of what government is about. Colin Powell was, you know, was a good soldier to Bush and quite a loyalist. But at the same time, he undermined Bush with leaks and all the rest from the State Department. The idea that somehow Hillary Clinton is less inclined to do that sort of thing strikes me as kind of ludicrous. And simply because it shows what a, you know, self-assured guy Obama is to pick, you know, this rival, in no way makes me less confident that Hillary Clinton will pursue an agenda that's good for her and the Clintons 2 years from now. Moreover, you know, Iraq may have been the central issue of the campaign, and it may be the central reason why Obama is president of the United States, but I don't think it's going to dominate politics going forward. And the whole concept of personnel as policy says it's not so much to deal with the known problem, it's to deal with the unknown problem. And if Obama is as left-wing as some of his people hope he is, to go into a new problem like the Mumbai massacres, or whatever the next one is, or the next 9/11, or the next you know, problem in Afghanistan, to have a cabinet that is to your right on a whole bunch of things. If I were a real left-winger, I would be more chagrined by Obama's picks than they have been so far, because I think that the you know, as we did learn from the Bush administration, your staff has an enormous deal to do with the filtering of information that makes it to the Oval Office.
Yeah,
and,
well, that's
and those people are going to have a filter that's different than Obama's own, and they're going to constrain the choices available to them.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I guess I think that. I think Obama also, the choice of Gates, you know, which is obviously kind of a continuation with the end of the Bush administration, it, you know, suggests, I think, you know, that Obama recognizes that he may not be able to focus most of his attention on Iraq and on foreign policy at all because of how massive the economic problems are. And so that's why it's good to have a guy who's, you know, who's already in the Defense Department who can manage some kind of withdrawal from Iraq. In a more orderly way. You know, it's true that Powell, my reading of the Bush administration is that Powell got into this, ended up getting into this vicious fight with Cheney and Rumsfeld, and that was all partly because the whole system was so dysfunctional. It was being played out to some degree in the press, whereas in fact, in reality, if you read the books that have come out around about Bush, which I now have, I mean, you see that there was very, very little open discussion actually in Bush's presence. Powell really was really barely ever had the opportunity to basically say to Bush, look, I think this is really, you know, I think this is a mistake. He was constantly getting blindsided by decisions that he wasn't able to argue against. I don't think that, so I think it's good to react against that. I mean, the team of rivals thing only really is true for Hillary Clinton. And
Much to John Edwards' chagrin.
You know, I think it's based on a shrewd assessment of the fact that ambitious politicians in your own party with a powerful power base have historically caused problems for presidents of their own party. John McCain caused some problems for George W. Bush early on. Ted Kennedy caused all kinds of problems for Jimmy Carter. You don't want a rival power center in your own party. You know, the other parties cause is difficult enough to deal with, and I think that she was the only person who would have potentially had that. Now, it wouldn't have been a problem if Obama had done well, but if Obama had stumbled, then she would have been in the natural position to kind of exploit that weakness. And I think now, basically, her success is his success, pretty much. It's really hard to have a successful Secretary of State in an unsuccessful administration. And I think, in that regard, I mean, this is pretty much the conventional analysis, but I think it makes a lot of sense.
I agree with that, for the record. I agree with that. There has been a lot of purple prose about the genius of all of this and about how high-minded it all is. And I think the reality is that it's a far more, you know, maybe cynical is not the right word, but it's a far more calculated realpolitik decision than some romantic notion of a sort of school of Athens in the White House where he's going to have all these people holding, you know, Socratic debates and whatnot.
Well, that's, you know, but I mean, the successful politicians are successful presidents are people who understand politics. And I think that, you know, one of the things that Obama has shown, I think, really remarkably, is a guy who hasn't been in politics for very long. Is in some ways, I think, how sophisticated and shrewd he's been in terms of understanding the way power is deployed. You know, I think on the merits, I also think Hillary Clinton certainly is not only is good, but probably better than John Kerry or Bill. I mean, if you look at the other names that were being floated out there, I think even on the substance, I think she probably is better than them. On the question of the liberal blogosphere, you know, if you look at the agenda that Obama is pushing, it's true he may delay the expiring of the Bush tax cuts, and it's true he may delay to some degree, the withdrawal of Iraq, although that's hardly news. I mean, he was been signaling that for a long time. I don't think there's that much for liberals to complain about, because what you want if you're a liberal is just what you wanted a conservative in 1980-81. You want a big agenda. You want someone who says, you know what, we're going to take this opportunity by the horns and try to fundamentally change things. And if you look at the size of the stimulus numbers being floated, plus how serious he seems about health care, plus how serious he seems about the whole environmental energy thing, that is a massive, massive agenda. I mean, that's a big, big, fundamental, historic shift. On foreign policy, it's more ambiguous. But if I had to guess, my guess is they will go hard after a deal with Iran, which would also be a very bold, very ambitious move in foreign policy. So I think that Obama's put in place people like Gates and Jones and these economists who have the best shot of getting that agenda through. So I don't really see what there is to complain about particularly.
Well, I mean, as you say, successful presidents understand politics. There aren't a lot of self-styled progressives or leftists or whatever in this administration. And again, look, I'm perfectly happy given the alternatives with – not perfectly happy, but, you know, quite pleased given the alternatives. But if – let's say this was a Republican administration and you had no sort of movement – base of the party, Republican conservatives in the cabinet, we would be very upset. And I find it very hard to imagine that we would be entirely placated with the argument that, oh well, look, you know, Christy Todd Whitman and William Cohen and Warren Rudman, these guys really understand the system and they are going to be incredibly useful in implementing the president's agenda. We wouldn't be sold with that argument, and I don't blame. I'm not saying that there should be an automatic, abandonment of Obama even before he's inaugurated or anything like that. But if I were the guys at the Nation, if I were the guys at the American Prospect or something like that, I would be
I don't think that these terms, left and right, progressive and liberal, add very much value divorced from the specific kind of issues you're talking about. And so, where are the debates on which these Obama appointments are at variance with the liberal base? On the size of the stimulus, which would arguably, you could say, the biggest, the big debates seem to me are a really big stimulus or a medium-sized stimulus. Do you really push full square on health care? And it seems to me on those two debates, it seems to me clearly moved in the liberal direction. Now maybe on climate change we'll see. We'll see whether they push as hard for a cap and trade, and if it's a cap and trade kind of thing that the progressives really like. But I think the center of gravity in the Democratic Party has moved to the left in a way such that people like Summers and Rubin proteges are basically on a lot of these issues. Very ambitious in the same way that progressive bloggers are. Now, there may still be a difference on free trade. I don't think that's going to have the salience at the beginning. But if I had to guess, I would guess that if there's a difference between Obama and if these guys reflect a certain predisposition on trade, it may be that that's really where Obama himself is. And on foreign policy, if you look at Gates and even Jones and what they've said about Guantanamo Bay and what they've said about Iran and basically their predispositions about Iraq, I don't see those as terribly different from where the liberal base is. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I think there has been a bit of an ideological convergence between the liberal blogosphere and the kind of mainstream of the Democratic Party since the 1990s. And that's why I don't feel that the divisions are really as sharp as they're sometimes being portrayed to be.
Oh, no, I think that's all true. I think it's, just as a side note, I think it's interesting how you're talking, you basically, and you've done this before, you use the left-wing blogosphere as wholly and completely interchangeable with what we used to call the left. And you said there's been this convergence between mainstream liberalism and the mainstream democratic establishment. And the left-wing blogosphere since the 1990s. Well, the left-wing blogosphere didn't exist prior to 2003. And I just think it's sort of interesting how, I'm not criticizing you, I think it's generically done that way these days, and it's sort of interesting, and it's a topic for another day.
But I think that makes my point, actually, which is to say, the liberal blogosphere that emerged, let's say, starting after impeachment, is not as ideological as the Nation. So the Nation is the kind of embodiment, the kind of Nation Jesse Jackson wing of the Democratic Party that goes way back, that goes all back into debates in the 70s and 80s about things like welfare and crime and nuclear freeze and a whole in Central America, a whole set of issues. Those people, the liberal blogosphere is much more, those people were always not sure whether they wanted to be inside the Democratic Party or outside the Democratic Party. Whether they wanted to support Ralph Nader types, whether they wanted to flirt with the Green Party, as the Nation often has. They saw themselves as somewhat outside the system. What's striking about the liberal blogosphere is it sees itself completely inside the system, inside the Democratic Party, and it is often more interested in winning elections and the mechanics of campaigns and elections than it is in ideological purity. And I think that's part of the reason that I don't think that the gap is as large. Which is to say, I think the gap is probably larger with the Nation than it is with Daily Kos.
No, I think you're probably right. We've talked about this before about how the obsession with winning and power has sort of supplanted a lot of the old doctrinal arguments. All I would sort of put forward is that there's a sort of a tension between your two positions on this. When you said, which was what I was trying to get at when I pointed out how you said that good presidents, successful presidents understand politics. Whether it's based in the liberal blogosphere or at the Nation or at Brown University or something like that, there is still something like a serious left out there. It may be a rump of its former self, but it still exists out there. And in the past, these sorts of factions are better and more easily placated if they've got someone on the inside making their case for them. And We saw this, you know, with the Scoop Jackson Democrats and the Coalition for the Democratic Majority. We've seen this, you know, with countless Republican administrations. And as it is right now, I mean, maybe I haven't been following this as closely as you have. There just doesn't seem to be any sort of Robert Borisage type in the Obama administration that can reach out to that crowd the way, you know, there's always been in previous Democratic administrations. There's always been in, say, the Republican administrations, you have someone who can reach out to the evangelical right or reach out to the Larry Kudlow crowd.
I think, you know, the Labor does have some people who are, his political director is a Labor guy. There are a couple of people from Labor. But, you know, I mean, again, one of the things that there's a certain kind of elephant in the room here, which is, in some ways, the most important, largest block in the Democratic Party that is African Americans. And so, you know,
they're taking care of them.
They've done pretty well. So, you've got feminists and women. You know, I think Hillary Clinton is helped. So there are a lot of women in top positions. You know, there've been talk about whether there are enough Hispanics, and there may be a little bit of grumbling amongst Hispanics. They didn't get a top level appointee. I think Obama would be really shrewd to choose an Hispanic Supreme Court nominee to try to lock down that a little bit. But I think again, I think the fact that you have an African American president just changes the ball game in a lot of ways. And I think the other thing is, I mean, in the same way that Bush, because of his close personal affiliation with evangelicals, I think that many people thought that he was their guy in the White House.
No, sure.
I think the other thing...
But Bush picked Ashcroft, which...
Yes, that's true.
Bush settled all of that.
Yes. I think the other thing is we have to remember that when a president is riding high and delivering a couple of big things that people in their base really want, people cut him a lot of slack. I mean,
sure.
When the right was really, really happy about Bush's response to 9/11, all kinds of stuff, his big spending or whatever stuff, basically was all... And I think that if I were Obama, I would think about it in those terms. I would think, look, if I deliver a huge stimulus... which is going to, you know, the 21st century, you know, WPA, whatever, New Deal, plus I get health care, which is basically something that every Democrat has tried to do and failed, then, you know what, then you could quibble with me on the small stuff, guys. But
sure.
Basically, you'd be so fat and happy that, and I think that's probably usually true. People start quibbling about stuff when they don't feel like there's some big central thing that the guy has done for you.
Yeah, but Peter, I mean, those are... two enormous ifs, you know. I mean, the stimulus thing I think is more likely because of the situation we're in. But the idea that he's going to deliver, you know, it's sort of like that old Steve Martin routine, you know, first get $1 million. First deliver epical, sweeping, once-in-a-century change, and then the gut will come along with you on your personnel hirings.
No, I mean, if he fails, I mean, we saw this with the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration was never the same once they failed on health care. If he fails on health, I mean, I think that the scars are much, much more aligned now than they were in 1983.
Sure.
I think he's got a much better chance. But if he fails, I think you're right. Then I think that is a huge, huge blow.
The other thing I would just point out very quickly is, and I know we've been around the horn on this all a bunch of times, but just as sort of a cultural thing, for want of a better, a sociological thing. When you sort of go into this thing about how, the ideological, when we were talking about the ideological base and the liberal blogosphere versus the old sort of nation crowd and all that kind of stuff, you made a very good and I think absolutely correct point, which is that the real base is the African American base of the Democratic Party, and then went into the thing about the feminists and the Latinos and all that kind of stuff, and as a conservative, you know, I'm perfectly willing to concede that, you know, conservatism is not totally bereft of something that passes for identity politics. But aesthetically, culturally, sort of vibrationally, I just find it so unpalatable. I would find it so difficult to be a liberal and argue about politics in terms of crass, pleasing, ethnic, and demographic constituencies like that, that you can use words like black, Hispanic, and woman as better ideological markers for intellectual debates and ideological factions. I just it is culturally unappealing to me.
Well, but you know, I mean, the flip side is the Democratic Party is a much more diverse place in the Republican Party, which is just
coalitional. Yeah, sure, okay. Sure.
Yeah, so we mean, you know, and the policy elite in the Democratic Party is much more diverse. So when you're just choosing meritocratically the best people for whatever, it's going to be a more diverse group. Now, that's not to say that Democratic presidents like Clinton and Obama don't carefully try to make sure they have their numbers of people. But I actually find, I mean, for me, what becomes really painful is watching Republicans try to be genuinely multicultural and now going nuts about the fact that they got some Vietnamese guy who won an election in Louisiana. Good for them. But it's because they have so few of those people that basically I find their process of trying to become multicultural as much more painful and often in some ways much less meritocratic because they just don't have a bunch of people to kind of call on. But actually, at least post-Bush, I think the expectation is that Republican administrations have to be close to as diverse ethnically, racially, and gender as Democratic ones do now.
Yes, but I think there's a lot of just nonsense in there. I mean, you're right that the Democratic Party looks is more diverse if you're going by skin color and the allocation of vowels and last names and the like. And it's not in terms of political positions, it is more diverse in terms of gender as well. Now, but to me, and I would think according to liberals, you know, you're the whole Parliament of Man, you know, crowd and all that. You would think that would be considered as from the high-minded intellectual bastions such as blogging heads. You would think that you would give more space to that stuff, to the idea that that stuff is epiphenomenal and superficial, and yet, you know, the diversity that you speak of is almost entirely superficial in these ways, except for this idea that, you know, there's this iron cage of identity and that there are real differences between blacks and Hispanics and women that are legitimate stand-ins for ideological positions. For the conservatives, there are very few people, you know, including, I would assume, this gal guy from Louisiana, who's actually arguing for the Vietnamese, you know, the Vietnamese American worldview in the Republican Party. There's, you know, Bobby Jindal isn't making arguments based upon an ethnic constituency, and there's no confusion of that. I mean,
What was the faith-based initiative, after all, if not basically a naked political attempt to basically give African American ministers money and then use them as a base to try to develop an African American political constituency in the Republican Party?
And Peter, I didn't like it. And I wrote that I didn't like it. I've been saying in countless blogging head things with you, I didn't like it. I don't like what Bush was trying to do with the Republican Party in terms of, I mean, some of it, you know, some of it may be necessary in practical politics in terms of reaching out to Latinos and, you know, how we're going to figure out this mess that we're in on the immigration issue is a perfectly legitimate thing. And I don't mind Spanish language ads and all of the rest as long as you get the policies right and sending certain cultural signals of inclusivity. I mean, I'm not a purist on these things. You know, that's all fine to me. But the argument that – I mean, you're the one who was using black and Latino and gender as important replacements – for ideological positions, and
now that's not really no, that's not what I'm saying. I mean, the truth is that in fact, if you look at the people in the Obama administration, you know, white, Latino, African American, I mean, they mostly basically agree about the same things. I mean,
I agree. I mean, that's the other tension then in your whole point is that the party is basically I'll scratch your back, you scratch mine. Can we get from the federal fisc? Ideas at all.
No, I mean, these people actually share a vision of government. You don't share that vision, but it has to do with the federal government taking a more active role in the market and trying to stabilize and humanize the market, yada, 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 create equal opportunity. I mean, that's their vision. That's their political vision. Now, you might say, why does it matter? Why couldn't it all just be a bunch of white guys doing that? Or for that matter, a Sam Mander group, and why should we care who it, you know, what the ethnic representation is? I think that part of this goes back to the debates about affirmative action to begin with, and the argument that basically people of diverse background tend to bring valuable perspectives to the room. The other is that particularly when you're talking about historically disenfranchised and discriminated against groups, the government has an important symbolic function, and it is important, I think, and valuable, particularly for people who have a conscious history of discrimination, to see themselves represented so that they know they can grow up to be those positions too. I mean, when Woodrow Wilson appointed, you know, Louis Brandeis, that was a big deal for Jews in the United States, and they had every right to feel it was a big deal, and for them to feel it was that they had a pride and investment in Brandeis than they wouldn't have had in a WASP progressive reformer who had exactly the same views. And I think particularly when you're talking about groups that have a long history of being treated badly in this country, I think that's very understandable.
I do too. I have no problem with inclusivity and whatnot. Although you should we should stop touting Woodrow Wilson unless you're just trying to bait me.
Well, I'll go to the mat for Louis Brandeis at least. Go ahead.
Fair enough. That's fair enough. And I'm all in favor of inclusivity. You know, and you've always had, you know, you have these various seats on the Supreme Court and all that kind of stuff. And I think that can be overdone. But, you know, at the same time, people see things through an ethno-cultural prism, blah, 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 and feeling like they're part of the American, you know, mainstream. That has a perfectly legitimate role in politics. But elevating it from a simple human area of practical politics to a profound ideological agenda, which you certainly have among the academic left, I mean, these arguments about, you know, whether, pitting, you know, race and gender and capitalism and all this stuff about whether or not you can ever escape from your identity, you know, your racial or ethnic identity and all these kinds of things, you know, whether logocentrism is a white, you know, phenomenon, all this kind of nonsense. That is what I find unpleasant. I also find simply unpleasant, which is my only basic point, which is that I would find it very difficult to live in a party that elevates these arguments about which hue of American is going to get this position because that is so important rather than anything else. And the transformation that we began this conversation in some ways, or the midpoint of this conversation, was about how the Democratic Party has become so unified in its desire for power and that everyone is basically on board and there isn't really this left that is outside the tent anymore because the liberal blogosphere is much more committed to the Democratic Party and blah, 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 blah. And that sort of, that bespeaks to me of an ideological conformity that when everything else is so uniform, these issues of identity politics become all the more important. And I just, as a cultural milieu, I would find it sort of unpleasant to be part of all that.
But I mean, I think the striking thing about, you know, if you were talking about 1972 or 1984, where the Democratic Party had these big, messy conventions in big fights about who would be the party officers, and then fights about you know, making sure that every different group had a plank in the platform. You know, at that point, I think there was something genuinely unseemly that hurt the party about seeming to be so obsessed with multiculturalism that it basically had no unifying agenda, didn't stand for anything larger. But, I mean, look, Obama did not go around. I mean, the whole point of Obama, it seems to me, is his very self-conscious universalism. He never tried to talk about himself as an African-American candidate for president. And I think, in a way, you know, yeah, they have tried to make sure that they have a few Hispanics in some positions, which is just politics, basically. But in reality, I don't think that, you know, whatever is going on in the academic left, I don't see the Obama administration and the people around them spending most of their time, you know, saying that these identity questions are the most important thing. Mostly what they're saying is, you know, how do we get this really, really big agenda through that changes the kind of terms of political debate? I just don't kind of, as someone who's, I guess, closer to the Democratic Party orbit than you, I don't feel this kind of oppressive sense of being weighed down by multiculturalism that you seem to perceive.
Well, in terms of the Obama administration, I think you're largely right. The only reason I brought it up is because you were talking about it. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that, you know, in 72, mm-hmm. all of that stuff, you know, the McGovern rules and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, and which, you know, Jesse Jackson mm-hmm. gets seated or Daley mm-hmm. gets seated, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
The reason why that seems so unpleasant in hindsight is because there was really real and profound disagreement about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, the McGovern rules have won out completely, and they are just taken as, you know, sort of dogma and run-of-the-mill organization of party politics. I mean, I remember a prominent Democrat once telling me how there's a standard, you know, first of all, the Democratic Party, you know, with the exception of the newspaper industry, probably has the most rigid affirmative action and racial quota rules of any major institution in America. And I remember one friend of mine who's a prominent Democratic bigwig, was telling me how if you hire a Hispanic for a position in the Democratic Party, you actually have to hire three Hispanics because there are, you know, a Mexican American has to get the job, a Puerto Rican American has to get a job, and a Cuban American has to get a job, all of equal rank. Otherwise, each faction will be upset. The other two factions will be upset. And I don't know if that rule is written or unwritten or whatever, but or if it's even still extant, but it was 5 years ago. And I just find that kind of – I would find that kind of thing exhausting. I'm not
– Yeah, but let's not pretend also that this is a new – I mean, you know, ethnic politics is a long history in the United States.
I know.
It had to do with appealing, you know, making sure Germans felt – you know, this is what – I mean, this is politics about getting votes. So, I mean, I think – I mean, is it the most edifying thing? No. But I think that – I mean, the truth of the matter is – to the degree the Republican Party wants to get votes, you know, wants to play in some of these groups as they have to, they're going to have to do the same thing.
I agree. They're going to have to do a lot of it. I don't dispute that. And they do a lot of that at the grassroots level. I mean, there are places where, you know, certain ethnicities are attached to the Republican Party and certain places they're not because of the diligent work at the grassroots level, blah, 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 blah. That's all fine. I mean, to a certain extent, it really doesn't bother me if it's just a matter of practical politics and all of the rest. And maybe the thing is, you're right, maybe for someone like me who is outside of your tent looking in, these distinctions between the sort of hard academic identity politics crowd and the sort of Blagojevich pay-to-play, you know, sort of, you know, machine politics world where this is just what you have to do, to me, one provides the intellectual rationalization of the other. And maybe you don't see it that way because that's not how it's actually lived. But from someone outside of the tent looking in, that's the way it seems to me.
Well, you know, maybe Rob Blagojevich will go and become a professor at Kenyon College, and then we can see how comfortable he and the academic left actually feel with one another. Should we do a little bailout stuff? Or what
yeah,
are you, what
sure,
are you thinking?
Sure.
You know, I don't know. I'm generally in favor of big stimulus. I kind of, on the auto bailout, I find it kind of hard to get, somehow I find it strangely hard to get worked up. I mean, I feel like in normal economic times, I feel like you would let these guys kind of go into bankruptcy, but I kind of am sympathetic to the argument that basically, we're not in normal times. We're potentially, you know, in an incredibly deep recession, and you need to try to avoid things that are going to dramatically exacerbate that. That's why I think Obama was probably right to delay raising the income taxes, because basically you don't want to do anything that is basically that is anti-stimulatory at this point. And I just worry that at this particular point, as opposed to in a normal economic time, basically letting these guys go into bankruptcy and basically flooding the upper Midwest, which is already just an absolute disaster zone, with vast new numbers of unemployment, you know, laid off people and people who would foreclose on their homes, it just seems to me to be sending this economy, would be sending us further in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit there. I mean, I think there's this funny disconnect. You know, if the big three go under, and technically, you know, that's one of these stolen bases you hear a lot, is we're talking about them going under, and bankruptcy is not going under.
Yeah, well, there's a debate about whether they could, you know, there's a debate about all what they
I understand, but I mean, but as a generic proposition,
yes.
Very few people are arguing, oh, let's just close down all three you know, auto companies.
Yes.
There is still a disconnect in that, you know, if, say we don't bail them out, and a half a million or a million auto workers are laid off or let go, 2 months from now, if you did some sort of stimulus that rehired half a million or a million auto workers, oh, it's a huge success, you know, blah, blah, blah. So and I can certainly see the logic from a policymaker's perspective of saying, you know, let's not throw gasoline on the fire and let's keep these things afloat. I also understand, you know, the rank political, you know, legacy concerns from the Bush White House of just trying to kick the can down the road.
Sure.
And, you know, these guys got, you know, what, 30, 60 days left, 55 days. You know, I wouldn't want to be, you know, go out on the note of closing down the auto industry. I mean, at least if you kick the can down the road, it's Obama's problem. It's what Obama wants Bush to do anyway. And I think Cheney was right, is that the Republicans would, even though Hoover's were grotesquely misunderstood, would go down in history as Hoover-esque if they did nothing. The the flip side is that this has got to end at some point. When Boehner, I wrote this column about this back then, when Boehner signed on to the bailout plan, back in, September, he said, it's a crap sandwich, but I'm going to eat it anyway. And I predicted at the time, crap sandwiches for as far as the eye can see. And so far, that seems to be the case. And I think in normal times I would be entirely in favor of the auto companies going into Chapter 11, and if that meant painful resizing and maybe the two weaker ones merge and become one or whatever, that would all be fine by me. I find a lot of the arguments used, I understand why Jennifer Granholm and Carl Levin and these guys are desperate to keep the auto industry alive, and they're using they're using any weapon near to hand arguments for a lot of stuff, which I find nonsensical and all the rest. So, at the end of the day, I guess I'm still intellectually against a bailout, but I think it's a much tougher call than it would in our normal times be.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. You know, as you said, a lot of this politics is just basically regional, and I do think there's an interesting, I think Democrats and Republicans see the auto industry, and not just the auto industry per se, but I think they see the life of the auto worker in different ways. I mean, I think for Democrats, it's very painful and tragic to see the life that an auto worker in the United States had basically disappearing. Democrats don't see those people as basically kind of fat and lazy guys who were basically, sucking off the system. They basically see that as that's basically the way life should be for working class people, and it's kind of tragic that basically that seems impossible to sustain anymore. Whereas when I hear these Republican senators from the South who basically, have states where there's no union, where very, very low unionization rates, and they have some auto industry stuff perhaps at significantly lower wages with less good health care and no unions, there seems to be almost a kind of a relish in destroying the kind of working class existence that once existed for people in the North. I think so just attitudinally, I feel like there's a very different kind of emotional reaction you tend to find on on both sides of the aisle here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of, just for record, I think there's been some unfair scapegoating of Southern senators who were against all of this. I mean, Krugman said the other day on Stephanopoulos that Corker is the senator from Nissan, even though he's actually got GM plants in his state as well. A lot of these Japanese automakers came to the United States precisely because the unions insisted on it. These were democratic laws that were passed so that, they would have a level playing field, and they thought they were going to be able to unionize these Southern auto plants, and it turned out that a lot of these Southern auto workers don't want to join the union. And,
It's also difficult to unionize in the South, but go ahead.
Sure, it's a complicated story, but it's not one of mustache-twirling Southern senators who just want to, crush the life out of Northern, auto workers.
Very few of them have mustaches,
and they would be against twirling. It's too effeminate sounding. I agree. It's a weird drama, and and I can understand the real frustration from the auto industry and from sort of upper Midwest blue collar guys who don't appreciate these sort of finely hewed intellectual arguments for bailing out all these Wall Street firms who they just see as other businesses, and they don't understand this utility argument that that if you don't have a ready supply of capital, no business works. And I'm very sympathetic to that argument, even though I can't stand a lot of the Wall Street bailout stuff. It's just deadly poisonous politics. And my guess is, may even be happening today. I saw something with the TV on mute earlier about some noise from the White House. This may all be settled by the time this airs. So maybe we shouldn't get too deep in the weeds on it.
Well, let me ask you one last question. What is for prediction? What is the thing? I mean, right now it seems to me you have a situation where conservatives, pleasantly surprised by Obama, obviously don't love him like liberals, wouldn't have voted for him, but haven't really gotten their dander up. But you guys will. So the question is, what's going to do it? What is going to be the thing that Obama does that all of a sudden conservatives say, by golly, time to go on the warpath?
Card check is one. Uh-huh, I think that mm-hmm. everyone
That'll
has
be
got.
An interesting decision.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has got their arguments ready. Mm-hmm. The Chamber of Commerce crowd mm-hmm. is going mm-hmm. would go to the mattresses on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but the truly explosive one, which I don't think is going to happen, mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. it would be fairness doctrine. I mean, you would just see, all of talk radio go nuts. Mm-hmm. Sales of my book would go through the roof, and it would be an enormous big deal on the right. Those two more conventional ones would be healthcare, but that's sort of a slow burn fight. That is not a sort of flip the safeties on your your rifles kind of thing. And then conceivably something on foreign policy. If day one he
closing Guantanamo.
I don't think so. I mean, uh-huh. There were enough Republicans, including Bush,
yeah.
who said that the goal was to close the place.
Yeah.
I think the investment in – it depends. I think what could do it is if you saw something like – remember the whole thing with Jimmy Carter? And I'm just thinking out loud here, but you remember that whole thing, that reason why Clinton always hated Carter was because of the
Mariel
Boatlift refugees from Cuba?
Uh-huh.
If it depends – the only way I think Gitmo could really set off a firestorm on uh-huh. the right uh-huh. is if Obama did something really foolish – with the detainees who are in there.
Maybe just move them all to states that voted against him.
Yeah, something like, I don't know, something like that. Or, buy a house next to Bush's new place in Texas. But something something crazy like that. Or, signing a deal with Iran. But, again, I haven't thought about it too much. But definitely fairness doctrine and, to a lesser extent, card check.
Yeah,
would really set everybody off.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the card check one is going to be really interesting. I think a lot we'll learn a lot about Obama. And I mean, I like card check,
because your commitment to the secret ballot has always been so weak.
I will ignore that gratuitous slap. I think that'll be a very revealing choice. I mean, that'll be one of the really interesting ones to watch. I agree.
Yeah. All right, my friend. It was good to chat.
Yes.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.